Writers' Voices, and I am Cheryl Fusco Johnson, subbing today for Monica Hadley, who couldn't be with us. However, we have two wonderful guests today, both poets laureate. First, we're going to be speaking with Walter Bargan, who is the poet laureate for Missouri, and then we're going to be speaking to Iowa's poet laureate, Mary Swander. So this first half hour, we're going to be talking to Walter, and I want to introduce him. First, I'll say hello, Walter.
Hello. I hope your weather is lovely up there. It's finally cooled off here.
We've had a little bit of a break as well, so that's good for all of us. So Walter Bargan lives in Ashland, Missouri. He's published 13 books and two chapbooks of poems over the last 28 years. Among his work is The Feast, Prose Poem Sequences, which won the 2005 William Rockhill Nelson Award for Best Poetry Book by a Missouri Writer. His work has appeared in more than 100 magazine publications, including American Literary Review, International Quarterly, Missouri Review, and River Styx. Bargan has been recognized for his literary achievements as a recipient of a National Endowment for the Arts Poetry Fellowship, that was in 1991, and as winner of the Quarter After Eight Prose Prize in 1996, the Hanks Prize in 1996, and the Chester H. Jones Foundation Poetry Prize in 1997. Walter Bargan holds a bachelor's degree in philosophy and a master's degree in English education from the University of Missouri, Columbia. He was appointed to be the first poet laureate of Missouri in 2008 and 2009. So my first question for you, Walter, first, of course, welcome, is what is your role as the poet laureate, and was it a surprise to you when you were appointed?
Yes, it was quite a surprise. The process was happened fairly quickly, but there were like 135 people who were considered to be in the running, nominees, and that was reduced down to four finalists, and then those four finalists may or may not have all been invited to an interview with the governor. And I was quite surprised to be one of the four finalists. And when I went down to Jefferson City, where the Capitol is, I expected that it would just be a kind of perfunctory, you know, handshake hello and handshake goodbye. And I ended up spending 45 minutes speaking with the governor, talking to him about poetry, which was certainly, again, a surprise to me. And the first thing that he said when I sat down was, "Oh, I'm a great fan of poetry. I just finished reading The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot for the third time."
Wow, that's really interesting. I also want to mention to our listeners that one of the reasons we're speaking to Walter and Mary today is a book has recently come out called An Endless Skyway, Poetry from the State Poets Laureate. And it was edited by Walter and three other people, Karen Miriam Goldberg, Marilyn Taylor, and Denise Lowe. And all of the editors, I believe, are also Poets Laureate.
That is correct.
So not every state has a poet laureate. I think I read in the introduction maybe 33 out of the 50 states. And I'm curious, do you know what the impetus was in Missouri? Why suddenly? Do you think it's because your governor does have an interest in poetry? Was it his initiation of this idea?
Actually, there most states have an organization called Center for the Book, and usually it's preceded by the state name. So there's the Missouri Center for the Book, and a group of people within that organization had lobbied for almost a decade through maybe three different administrations in the state to get the position created. And when Governor Blunt created the position, it caught everyone by surprise because it was getting towards the end of his term. And everyone was just thinking, well, you know, perhaps the next governor will make that decision. But Governor Blunt did make it. What was his reasoning for it? You know, I'm not exactly sure. Maybe it was his interest in poetry. Maybe it was this strange little competition that there is between Missouri and Kansas. And Kansas had created the position, so Missouri followed suit.
Well,
I don't know.
Well, has it impacted your life much to be the poet laureate? How is your life different than it was before you were appointed?
Well, you know, it's really, it's almost slapstickish in a way. I fully expected that I would get a little certificate that I would have to pay for framing it, and I would hang it on my wall, and that would be it. But oh my gosh, it was just the opposite. You know, it was like being pulled out of some cloud of anonymity and being thrust into the public.
Really?
I really was not expecting so much attention and so much demand for my presence.
Well, that's great. So,
I would never have thought that many people were that actively interested in poetry and wanted to hear poetry. I've jokingly said that for the first 6 weeks, every breath that I took was recorded.
Well, that's probably taken a little time from your actual writing, but I'm sure that's very refreshing to find so many people interested in what you do as a poet.
Oh, yes. Now, my writing precipitously declined. It was kind of like the stock market.
And how long of a term do you serve in Missouri?
In Missouri, it's a two-year term. The Missouri Center for the Book studied all the different models for that other states had used to create the Poet Laureate, and this kind of has become a typical model of a two-year term.
And so what are some of your duties?
Well, you know, there really aren't, originally they had said something about that I would write a state poem, that each Poet Laureate would write a state poem, and then they rescinded that thinking that, well, you know, that could just demanding a poet to write a poem could create writer's block.
I think that it seems like you're pretty prolific. I kind of feel like
before
maybe
before they even rescinded removed that particular requirement, I had already written what I considered to be the state poem, which was called Moonwalk Missouri.
Now that one is not in An Endless Skyway, is that right?
No, it isn't.
That was another question that I had for you is, when a poet is asked to do something, like you contributed 6 poems to An Endless Skyway, and they're very diverse, and it shows that you have an interest in what's going on globally, you know, like what's happened in the past in other countries, and you're very aware of contemporary events. And, I just thought I would open the book and every different state that was represented, I would find like a state poem. And I found yours to be much more global in its awareness. And I'm curious, when you're making a collection of poetry or when you're asked to contribute poetry, how do you choose which poems make a set? You know, like what goes together?
Well, I torture myself to begin with, you know, trying to make that decision. And, you know, I say, well, maybe this one. No, how about this one? And it's really actually quite difficult, you know, to think about having 13 books and then having to select 6 poems out of those 13 books. What would be representative? Am I really concerned about being representative? Do I just want the best? You know, hopefully what's representative in the best is the same thing, but, you know, not necessarily. When I put a book of poems together, rarely do I just put a collection of poems together. There's always some theme or some image, something that creates an actual book of poems and not just a collection of poems. So, for example, Remedies for Vertigo is, all tied together by the idea of flight and all its meanings, and birds and planes. I have a trilogy of books that under one title now called The Body of Water, and it's the 3 books in there, Yet Other Waters, The Vertical River, and Water Breathing Air. Well, you know, you hear what ties that together. What is the setting for all of those poems? So I'm always looking for a larger theme than just a poem to put a book together or to put any collection together.
Uh-huh. I was interested in these particular 6 poems, that there seemed to be a connection between violence among people and, like, violence in the animal kingdom. In some of the poems. And I think that's sort of the job maybe of poets, is you make connections that other people don't see. And do you feel that's the case? Like, is the mind of a poet different than the mind of, say, a mystery writer or someone who writes prose?
Oh, gosh. you know, I can't remember his name right now, but he's he writes prose poems, and he said that prose and poetry are two sides of the same coin. And in some ways, I think it's an artificial demarcation, a separation between the two, because you know, if you think about prose, when you read a novel, oftentimes the things that you remember most beyond the plot are those few pages or those few images, and you say, "Oh, those were the most poetic parts of that particular book." You know, prose without poetry is flat-footed. And poetry without prose doesn't know how to tell a story.
Huh.
So they really are—they really do dance together. Did I answer your question?
I think you did. Yes. So there's more of a connection. I guess I really can see that because I tend to like prose best that has a rhythmic quality and that does have vivid images. And I think I like poems best, me personally, you know, that has kind of a storyline to it. So I'm not, you know, don't know what it's like for everybody, but I do have a question about poetry and people in general. And a lot of times when I hear people talking about poetry, there's a kind of a feeling expressed that the poetry that's important in contemporary times is generally that's in songs, you know, like song lyrics, that's the poetry of today. And I feel like that's kind of a limited view, but I do hear that expressed a lot. And what can you tell us about all the rest of the poetry that's being written?
Well, there's certainly an enormous amount of poetry being written. And, you know, some of it is great and will, you know, survive the test of time. And a lot of it will be written and read a few times and then put away and not ever seen again. You know, the difference between the lyrics to a song and writing a lyric poem sometimes is there's not that much of a difference, but generally speaking, you know, you can do things in a poem that you can't do in the lyrics. You know, you've got to continue very strictly the rhythm of the song, except in rare cases. Whereas when you have the rhythm in a poem, you can vary that to a lot of very subtle ends that you can't necessarily do with music. You know, music is its own language, and it's a very beautiful language. And sometimes it just seems like lyrics are attached to that the beautiful language of music. Whereas, you know, with a poem, the music of the poem is integral, but it's the images and the words that are creating that music itself and not a stringed instrument or a flute or whatever.
Do you think that poets are influenced by music? I mean, not poets that are writing song lyrics, but, you know, poets in general. Like, do you listen to much music? I'm just curious where poets get their sense of rhythm. Is it from hearing a lot of poetry read to them as children, or where does that come from, that ability to write in, you know, with a rhythmic quality?
Well, you know, I can't say that was my experience. You know, I didn't have a lot of poems read to me. In fact, I would say I had no poetry read to me.
How did you find poetry as a career? Because you've been doing it a long time, so, you know, you started this early on.
Well, you know, generally speaking, I kind of look back to eighth or ninth grade, when an English teacher got very frustrated with the class. And, you know, he very forcefully said, you know, clear your desks off, get out a blank piece of paper. And then he had very short instructions. He said, write an adult sentence. And, you know, being the students that we were, you know, hardworking and conscientious, we all spent about 20 or 30 seconds writing a sentence and handed it in. And he grabbed all the papers and took a quick look at them and then kind of threw them in the air, and there was this giant snowstorm of pages falling around him as he roared about none of us knew how to write an adult sentence. And, you know, basically what most of us had written was, you know, something akin to see, you know, Dick run, see Jane catch the ball. And, you know, that kind of really caught my attention, because he was suggesting that language could do something so much more than what I was capable of at that point. You know, perhaps he shamed me. I don't know. I don't suggest shame as a tool, but, you know, to get people to learn. But whatever he did in that particular instance got me interested in using language in a more evocative, more resonant fashion. And, you know, by the 11th grade, I was writing poetry.
Did you always think that you would then, you know, you studied philosophy and English literature, then do you teach poetry?
Unfortunately, no. I have an 8-to-5 job. I work for an organization called the Assessment Resource Center, and I consult with primary and secondary schools concerning assessments and often help them interpret their test results.
Does having a job that's not, you know, involving poetry, do you think in some ways that actually enriches what you do when you start to write?
Well, you know, I think it made me look for stories in places that other poets weren't looking for stories. And so that gave me an opportunity to have a subject matter that not everyone else had.
Yeah, very unique. Well, I think maybe our listeners would like to hear a little of your poetry. Before that, I just want to remind everyone you're listening to Writers' Voices. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson standing in for Monica Hadley, who's away today. And we are listening to Walter Bargan. He is the Poet Laureate in Missouri. And Walter, would you share one of your poems with us?
Did you have one in particular out of Endless Skyways that you would like me to read?
I think I'm going to let it be your choice.
Oh, okay. What about Civilized Sacrifice?
That was, it impacted me so much I had to go online and read about Juanita. And I had to pull up a picture, you know, to see. I think that's one of the things that's different about poets. Like, a lot of us will learn about something like the subject of this poem, and it will intrigue us, but then we go about our day. But poets can do something more, you know, and do something that is more satisfying for the rest of us. So reading your poem makes that child's story somehow a little less sad, you know, to have her immortalized in your poem. Would you like to go ahead and share that with us?
Yes, I'd like to say something first, though, because you brought up an interesting point, and that is that, you know, I think that I humorously call this my Brothers Grimm theory of poetic composition. There was a cartoon in the newspaper where this farmer was busting out of a barn. You know, the barn doors were being flung open, and he was waving a pitchfork in the air, and on the other side of the frame was a scarecrow, rather limp scarecrow, and it was covered with crows, and they were hanging on to this this scarecrow in really odd ways, you know, like one leg, tip of a wing, top of a head, the tail feathers, and the farmer was shouting, "Damn, Velcros again." And you know, that's the poet's that's my particular way of composing. Whatever catches my attention, I try to include in a poem.
Oh, like Velcro, like something that you kind of like obsess a little bit over.
Sometimes obsessing too much to the point where I don't know what to do with it any longer. But in this particular case, you know, I knew something about this particular mummy found on top of a Andean mountain peak. And I thought about all the times that I had been hiking in the mountains and what a transcendent experience hiking in the mountains is for me. And then I thought about the act of human sacrifice, and I tried to somehow understand those two, what seemed to me diametrically opposed experiences. But maybe they're not really. So anyway, here's the poem, Civilized Sacrifice. I have climbed the backs of gods, too. It's not so strange. Dressed in heavy coat and boots, hat pulled down to the eyebrows, cheeks windburnt, gloved fingers numb, and each brief breath preyed upon, each step thrown onto the loose altar of stone. Blinded by spires of light, I've looked away as the unblemished blue splintered in all directions. And I've backed away from the sheer precipice, the infinite suddenly a fearful measure, the way down to tundra and the jagged maze of granite, leaving only a crevice in which to cower. I've lain on the steep slopes at night under spruce, wrapped against rain and cold, and watched clouds explode in my face. Stark boughs reached and sagged back in a sweeping, resolute silence. I was shaken loose by thunder and lightning, like the small girl named Juanita by strangers. She tumbled 100 yards down Nevado Ampato Peak, her whereabouts unquestioned for 500 years, until a nearby volcano began a festering eruption, thawing the slope, and wrapped in her aliquia shawl woven in the ancient Cusco tradition, wearing a toucan and parrot feathered headdress, her frozen fetal posture a last effort at warmth above tree line amid ice fields, there to address and redress for rain and maize, for full vats of fermenting beer, plentiful llama herds, for the civilized sacrifice, to be buried alive and wait in private, as we all do, to speak with our gods, hoping to appease, to know, to secure the elusive cosmic machinery. And in that last numb moment, her left hand gripped her dress for the intervening centuries.
Oh, thank you. That was very powerful. And that image of her gripping her dress, I think that really brings her humanity to us. This young girl, like online what I read was she was probably 14 at the time she was sacrificed. And even though she had all this finery on, it's that poignant, you know, holding the dress with her hand that makes you realize this was a person once. And this is what her society decided her fate would be. And it's amazing the way poets can help us process information and sort of accept things, or maybe not accept things. A lot of your poetry, to me, seems to be a call to action to people. How do you find subjects for your poems? Is it that Velcro? It seems like there's probably things that are Velcro to you, Velcroing themselves to you, that are very diverse. Is that the case?
Yes. I would hope so, because I would hate to get too focused on one subject and you know, I'm afraid I'd become boring if I just kept writing about the same thing over and over again. But you know, I think that part of the process of writing for me, and probably most poets and writers know this, is that really ultimately writing is a process of discovery. You know, I write to discover what I think and what I feel. And, you know, when something sticks to me, I want to find out why it's sticking to me. And, you know, that's actually the most thrilling part of writing, is making those kinds of discoveries. You know, I call it writing through what I know into what I don't know, and know it for the first time.
When you're doing this process, like, how does it begin? So first, there's something that you notice you're thinking about a lot. Then do you take notes on that? Like, do you do journal writing?
Not really. I don't do a lot of journal writing unless you consider, trying to write poems daily, a kind of journal. And you know, many of the poems are just failures. You know, I start off and I can't seem to go anywhere with it, and so I put that down and I try to pick up another subject and write about it. But you know, it can start with an image, it can start with a phrase, it can start with overhearing something that somebody says that catches my attention, or it can be a story that somebody's told me and I think about, oh, I need to write a poem about this. But I never know how it's going to end, and I barely know how it's going to begin, and I certainly don't know the middle, but I want to get through it to the end.
Is there, do different poems take different lengths of time to be born?
Well, you know, many, you know, I'd say for about, 25 years of my writing, my first 25 years of writing, I tried to write a poem every day. And, that means I have a vast amount of material, but it's also a vast amount that is really unsuccessful. But, if I sit down, if I don't sit down and write, then the page remains blank.
Wow, so every day you would try to write a new poem?
Every day I would try to write a new poem.
And then would you go back to some of those to refine and polish?
Yes, that's exactly the process. But it also, you know, I usually write in a spiral notebook. And what I find is that I've got spiral notebooks back all the way to the end of high school.
Wow. Do you go back through and look and see, oh, this is what I was interested in when I was 20?
Well, you know, I keep thinking I'm going to do that, but I haven't yet. But I really do hope that I do that. You know, I may discover some things about myself that will really surprise me.
Now, you said that you did that for the first 25 years, and I think I read that you've been writing poetry for 28 years?
Oh, no, much longer than that.
Okay, much longer. So then what did you change your process to? So instead of writing a poem every day, what did you decide to do instead?
No, I think my process of composition changed and became more complicated, and it became more lengthy. And so it took more time. And so that, you know, I'm very happy if I can write and finish a poem once a week, a complete, you know, a good solid poem. And sometimes maybe I'll end up with two or three, but, you know, it's if I go for longer than a week without a really good solid poem, doubt begins to invade, and that pushes me to really get busy on writing a poem.
Now, how much of your time do you have to spend kind of mulling things over without actually sitting at your desk? Or do you do that like sitting at a desk?
Because I have a full-time job, I'm really just writing on the run. You know, take a note here, take a note there. Maybe once in a while in the evening I might have half an hour to try to pull some thoughts together. But, until I am able to retire, I probably will not have a real consistent block of time in which to write.
Let's see. I was going to ask you, do you feel that, though, that might be part of your process, where you're mulling things over and then you're busy with something else? You know, and that actually might be useful to work that way?
Oh, yes. Yes. No, I sometimes think the reason why I've been able to write so much is because, you know, my job has very little, if anything, to do with my writing.
Well, it's almost, our time together is almost up. Do you have any final advice for people who are interested in either acquiring the habit of reading poetry or the habit of writing poetry?
Well, you know, I'm firmly convinced that if you're going to be a writer, you have to read. Reading is the foundation of writing, and that writing itself is the best teacher of writing. And, you know, if you write every day, you will get better. And if you read every day and you read the people who are considered to be good, then you will begin to write better than you ever thought you could write.
Well, that sounds like really good advice, and I want to thank you for spending this time with us. And I'll see if I can develop a little bit more of the habit of reading poetry myself.
Oh, well, you know, everyone should read at least one poem every day.
That's great advice.
You know, and in fact, if you want to be a writer, then you need to be, or if you want to be a poet, you need to be reading one book of poems every week.
Okay, well, that's good and specific. So I think it's great to have specific advice. Thank you for being with us. We're going to have a little break, and then I'll be back on with Mary Swander. This is Writer's Voices. Goodbye, Walter.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much.
Thank you. is Cheryl Fusco Johnson with Writers' Voices. You're listening to KRUU FM 100.1, the voice of Fairfield Radio and beyond. And we have just been listening to Walter Bargan, a poet laureate from Missouri, and now we have the pleasure of listening to Mary Swander, the poet laureate of Iowa. In 2009, Governor Chet Colver appointed Mary the poet laureate of the state. Her most recent work is a book of poetry, The Girls on the Roof. She's worked with the Eulenspiegel Puppet Theater to create a performance piece from the girls for the stage. She's also currently touring her play Farmscape, which is a docudrama capturing the changing rural environment. She is the co-founder of Ag Arts, a national group designed to explore the intersection of the arts and agriculture, and she's developing a website, the Iowa Literary Community, where anyone with an Iowa connection can post poetry and other pieces of writing. Mary Swander's memoir, The Desert Pilgrim, has just been reissued by Ice Cube Press, as has the memoir Out of This World. She is the author of three additional books of poetry, Heaven and Earth House, Driving the Body Back, and Succession, as well as a book of literary interviews, Parsnips in the Snow, with Jane Snow. Mary Swander has edited three books, The Healing Circle, Authors on Recovery from Illness, with Patricia Foster, Bloom and Blossom, a collection of garden literature from Echo Press, and Land of the Fragile Giants. The University of Iowa Press reprinted Driving the Body Back in 1998, and she adapted that book to the stage. Mary has won many awards, including an Iowa Authors Award, a Whiting Award, a National Endowment for the Arts grant for the literary arts, two Ingram Merrill Awards, the Carl Sandburg Literary Award, and the Nation Discovery Award from The Nation magazine. Publishers Weekly named Parsnips in the Snow one of the best books of 1990, and the Garden Writers Association of America awarded Mary Swander their Quill and Trowel Award for Best Magazine Writing. Mary Swander received her MFA from the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. She's a professor of English and a distinguished professor of liberal arts and sciences at Iowa State University. And she lives in an old Amish schoolhouse, raises geese, goats, and a large organic garden, and plays the banjo. Welcome, Mary. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, one of the reasons we're doing our interview today is because of the book An Endless Skyway, Poetry from the State Poets Laureate, which was edited by Karen Miriam Goldberg, Marilyn Taylor, Denise Lowe, and Walter Bargan. So you have a selection in this book as well, is that right?
That's correct.
And I was wondering, how much do the poets laureate of different states interact? Have you met any other poets laureate?
Oh, yeah. We had a conference last March in Lawrence, Kansas, and I think 28 poet laureates were there.
How important is it for poets, you know, poetry writing is a very solitary enterprise, and how important is it for poets to meet as all of you poets laureate did? You know, why is that important?
Well, it helped to put us all on the same page. You know, the poet laureates are all picked in different ways by all the different states. Not every state has a poet laureate. Some are given a small stipend to do a project. Others, like here in Iowa, are paid absolutely nothing. But you have a great platform. And, you know, it really helped to combine our energies, see if there were interesting things that we could do to promote the arts. And then it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to meet. I knew several of the other poet laureates, but it was fun to get us all together.
So what are your job? What is your job? Like, what duties do you have here in Iowa as the poet laureate?
You have no duties. No. There is no money associated with the position, and you have no duties, and so, which is a kind of a interesting open-ended.
So it's sort of a quid pro quo.
So it was designed to be honorary. In other states, you do have duties. You're supposed to create a project or something. So when I received the position, I just went ahead and created some projects anyway. And one was, actually I was given some money from the old Des Moines Poetry Festival to set up a website. It's www.iowalit.com, and anybody can get on there from Iowa and post a poem or essay, short story, and get feedback from their peers. Another thing that I did was set up a free online creative writing course for people with disabilities, and I run that out of Iowa State University. And to find out about that, you can just get on my website, www.maryswander.com, email me, and I'll give you the information.
That sounds really interesting. So in that free online writing course, what is that like? When people visit the site, what do they find there?
Well, what it is, it's it was originally part of a program called Patient Voice Project, and it originated at the University of Iowa in conjunction with the Writers' Workshop and the University Hospitals, and then they contacted me and asked me if we would like to do it at Iowa State. And for, you know, Iowa State's an extension university, and so I said, if we do it here, what would make sense would be to do it online. In Iowa City, they were doing it one-on-one or in small groups. And so I set it up online, have one of my graduate students trained to teach the course, and we've been doing it now. This is the third year, and it's really great. It helps with people with disabilities online because it's hard often to get somewhere, to get to university. I wanted to reach around the state or beyond the state. I've had international inquiries about the course now, and I need some more funding. The Patient Voice Project funding has run out. They were funded by University of Iowa and Johnson & Johnson Company. So looking for somebody to step in. It doesn't cost very much money. It's once a year in the summer. The course is taught. So it's been great. I mean, it's reached people with all sorts of disabilities, from chronic depression to injuries from car accidents to autism, you know, just a range, a whole range, Parkinson's disease, a whole range of situations and ages.
Well, I'm sure whatever ails people, I mean, even people without disabilities, everybody likes to have an opportunity to express themselves. And that sounds like a wonderful project where people who are maybe not so mobile, as you're saying, would have an opportunity to learn something about presumably writing poetry. Is that right?
No, poetry. It can be poetry, fiction, nonfiction. Yeah, it's great. Then they have a community. Often last year the students continued to be in contact with each other after the course was over, and so they have a group, online at least. And then also with a student teaching it, in every case I've had a student who was either had a family member with disabilities, had disabilities themselves, or had worked with people with disabilities in previous occupations. So It was a great learning experience for them, too.
Yeah, it sounds like a really good project. So I wanted to ask you also, you've written both prose, because you've written memoir, and poetry. And do you find the process different?
Well, yeah, the prose is longer. it's tougher. Well, you know, I mean, both forms have a lot of challenge to them. But putting together a book of prose is a whole different experience than putting together a book of poetry, usually. I mean, I've written two books of poetry that are book-length collections, so it's kind of the same process. But, you know, you you approach both genres with different techniques in mind. That's for sure.
Do you do this like consecutively, or can you be working on things like writing a poem or some books, some poems for a book at the same time that you're writing passages that are going to be in your memoir?
I usually have got a couple things going at the same time, and it depends on your deadlines and things like that. But yeah, I can move back and forth pretty fluidly.
So how does your home environment influence what you're writing? Because it sounds like you live in a really colorful place.
Yeah, I do. I live in a very interesting, most incredible place, and it's entered in a lot. I wrote a book called Out of This World, and it's set in my old one-room schoolhouse that I actually live in, and I live in the middle of the Amish community near Kelowna. And so there's always something. It's a fascinating place to live. I mean, every day brings another experience that you think, I need to capture this on paper.
Now, I've read that book, but it's been over a year. But I remember that there were very colorful and kind neighbors that you had. And I'm curious, like, what is that like when you're writing about real people? Have they read it, and do they?
That's interesting. That's an interesting line to walk because, they are real people. They have feelings. It's often weird. People have written about me. It's weird to see yourself in a piece of writing. I always change the names of my characters, the real characters, in nonfiction, just to protect their privacy. But
do people recognize themselves though?
Careful. Pardon me?
Do people recognize themselves?
Oh, sure. They've actually been very generous about it, so they've been great.
Well, that's good. I think I want to do a station identification, and then if you would like to read us one of your poems, I think listeners would really enjoy that. This is Writer's Voices at KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield Radio and beyond. You can also find us online at kruu.com. And with us today is Mary Swander. She's the Poet Laureate for Iowa. And I am Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, standing in for Monica Hadley, who's away today. And have you found a poem you'd like to read to us, Mary?
Yeah, I'm going to start. This is the beginning of my new collection called The Girls on the Roof. And Girls on the Roof is a Mississippi River saga. And it's about two women stuck on top of the roof of a cafe on the banks of the Mississippi River for 3 days during the 1993 flood. And while they're up there, they both discovered a secret that they both have. So this is the opening, and it's 10 years after the flood, where everybody's come back from the tiny town of Pompey, Missouri, to retell the tale, to retell the story of the girls on the roof.
Okay.
So,
thank you for sharing this.
Yeah, sure. They're all coming into the cafe to tell their part, and the mother's name is Maggie, the daughter's name is Pearl, and Pearl's a waitress in the cafe, so she's taking down the story on her ordering pad. The day the levee broke, the day the mighty Mississippi washed Maggie and Pearl, mother and daughter, up on top of their catfish dive, the river rushed through our tiny town of Pompey. With a whoosh, crack, bam, boom, a power so Herculean that with one swift slap of its hand, the water knocked out all the windows and tore the door right off the hinges of Crazy Eddie's Cafe. The very gates of hell opened, and the great flood of the 20th century came crashing, dashing through. Maggie and Pearl had been warned. Sure, the whole town knew. Any fool could have seen it coming. Yep, and now, 10 years out, we're all back here at the great flood reunion. We sit in the cafe, landlubbers and river rollers, shaking our heads and clucking our tongues about those bad waters, the flow that carries us back to a different time, when the very ground under our feet gave way, and every twig we clung to floated off beyond our reach. And now, 10 years out, we struggle to remember that summer. Think about where we were and where we went when the big wall hit. We gather here together once again, the living and the dead, the seen and the unseen, the genuine and the ghosts, all who've come and gone, each taking a place at a table, in a booth, or on a stool, duct tape stuck to vinyl. We gather once again to piece together a tall tale, a story too long and wide for a single person to spin. We tilt back our chairs, watch turkey gizzards swimming in the mason jar on the counter, hear the waves lap at the banks outside the door, and realize just how lucky we are to be here on dry land with a beer in hand.
That was really nice to hear you read that. It made me feel just comforted. It's been a long time, really, since I've had somebody actually read to me. And, you know, I wanted to settle in and hear the whole book. But I do have to ask you some questions. So one of the questions I have, so this is all about the 93 flood. And you probably lived through that flood. Was your farm flooded? Were you living on the farm then?
Oh, I'm on top of the hill, so I didn't get flooded, but I sat here in my window and watched my neighbors at the bottom of the hill. It seriously flooded, and all around me it was flooded.
Yeah.
I was kind of a little island on top of it all.
So one of my questions is, in the part, an excerpt from the girls' book is in this new collection that came out of all the poets laureate. And yours was, I think it was Crazy Eddie from, what was the name of the poem that you had in the book? Crazy Eddie from the Judgment Day?
Right.
So he has a really interesting voice, and it sounds like he is the ghost of someone whose coffin maybe was flushed down the river. Is that right?
Crazy Eddie was... Crazy Eddie is owner of the cafe, and he is long dead, but he, if you remember the 1993 flood, the force of the river was so strong that it popped the coffins out of the cemetery along the river. So Crazy Eddie's little coffins popped up out of the cemetery, and he floats on down to New Orleans and hits the sandbar, and kind of wakes up down there, and he's really confused. He's really trying to figure it all out, and he decides this has to be the Judgment Day. What else could it be?
I really like the voice you created for Crazy Eddie, and it was like really colorful and vigorous and kind of rural and interesting. And I like that you gave him sort of messages, like one of the things that he, like one of the messages I got from his part of that book was, in this life we cannot lie down and pretend we're dead. We must keep moving no matter how futile it seems. And I just really enjoyed hearing that because I remember when everybody was sandbagging in Iowa City and I was there teaching during the more recent flood. And, you know, my course had to be canceled and I had to try to, you know, get out of Iowa City and get back to Fairfield. But you kind of captured the feeling that people had. I mean, everybody was so desperately sandbagging whether it was going to help or not. And there is just that kind of sense of whether or not it's going to work, you have to keep trying. And that's sort of true in all of life. So I don't know if that's the theme of that whole book, but in the Crazy Eddie section, I found that a really good message to get. But I'm wondering, like, where did you get his voice from? How did he appear to you as a character?
Out of folklore. I love folklore and Mississippi River folklore in particular. I grew up part of the time on the Mississippi River, and so I know these people. I know these characters, and so I invented his voice out of that background.
I'm also wondering, what influence does it have to teach? Are you teaching poetry at the university?
Yeah, I teach poetry writing, nonfiction writing, some playwriting.
What's the process like when you take poems and make them into something for the stage?
There is an adaptation of Girls on the Roof to the stage. It's one of my most fun things I've ever done. I worked with Eulenspiegel Puppet Theater, and Monica Leo and I perform the Girls on the Roof, and it's a great show. I play the banjo, we sing. Monica's made something like 30-35 puppets and does all the manipulation of all the puppets, and she made the set, and we've toured all around the state with that show. And
are you still doing that, or is that over with?
Yeah, no, that's totally available. Just again, contact me through my website, and we can set that up. We performed in libraries and colleges and universities, and it always has a great response. So
that leads me to another question. Now, when we have a lot of print media kind of disappearing, you know, like newspapers or magazines are kind of in their death throes, many of them, so what role is now left for poetry? Where is poetry going to be in a digital age?
Well, it's going to be where it always has been. And, you know, it was the first genre. All the other genres grew out of poetry. We were there before newspapers and magazines and plays and novels. And, you know, so poetry will always survive. I mean, the lovely thing about poetry is most people carry it around, you know, and know it by heart. And so it's still the one form that has an oral tradition. So it'll survive any of the permutations. But the web, actually, there's some really neat websites now that publish poetry. The digital revolutions actually help poetry, I think, in many ways. It's always really nice to have a beautifully, beautifully printed book with a lovely poetry on it. That's, you know, number one in my book. But there's just some fascinating things that go on digitally now on the web with poetry. There's sites where people just post auditory poems that they're reading, or they have sound effects too. There are sites where people write poems on their cell phones. I mean, you know, a lot of it isn't great poetry, but it's a lot of fun, and why not? It promotes poetry.
So that's a good point. So this is actually a good era for poets, because they can find a way to meet each other, and also, I guess, poetry really is intended to be oral. Would you say that's true? It's sort of more fun to hear poetry or to read it aloud to yourself than it is to read it, you know, in a book.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, that's why we had rhyme and rhythm in the first place, because it was easier to memorize then, when all literature was oral. That's why poetry was the key genre.
I had an interesting experience not long ago. I'm in a couples book club where, you know, husbands and wives are in this book club together. And one of the men suggested that instead of reading a book, we each memorize a poem and perform it at our next meeting. And all of us were a little, I would say most of us anyway, had a lot of trepidation about doing that. And I chose to memorize Happiness by Robert Haas because my son had given me that book of poetry for Christmas the year before. And I hadn't memorized a poem, I think, probably since sixth grade. And it was, it really gave me an appreciation for language and for how the poem had been put together. And do you find that's the case? Like, do you like to recite poetry, or do you suggest your students memorize any poetry?
Yeah, no, I think it's really, really, really helpful. As you say, you really get inside the skin of the poem. You hear the poem for the first time in a different way.
What poets have influenced you in your career? Like when you were, I guess that also leads me to the question, how did you get started as a poet?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a big range of influences. I as a major poet, Canterbury Tales and Chaucer's the book that I always come back to, and then I like a lot of different voices. Robert Browning, I like the dramatic monologue in the contemporary era. I like Elizabeth Bishop a lot. You can see a lot of those influences in my work.
What sort of advice do you give to your students, or would you give to other people who are interested in writing poetry? Like, let's say, what are the three best things they could be doing to create a life where they're able to write poetry?
They need to read a lot. It always amazes me that, students will end up in my class and they've never, read poetry. But they want to write it. And those are usually the songwriters, the people that come in that are in a band or something like that. But nonetheless, there's great songwriters too, poets. So, you really, really need to read as much poetry as you possibly can. You just have to read and absorb. And then you need to write. And lots of people like to say they're poets, but they never sit down in the chair, so you actually got to get yourself in a chair and write. And then the third thing is you have to arrange your life somehow to give yourself time to write. And, however you're going to do that is, if it's just closing your door at noon at your desk for an hour and writing every day that way, or some people like to go off in little retreats and where they're away from the rest of the world, write that way. Whatever it takes, and then of course you have to support yourself in the meantime. It's not a lucrative career. It's not a career that makes any money, so you have to have your day job in place too.
Well, I think we've about come to the end of our time here. But I want to thank you so much for being with us, and I want to remind listeners, we've been listening to Mary Swander. She's the Poet Laureate of Iowa, and we appreciate the efforts you've been doing to keep poetry alive in our state. And thank you for being with us. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson.
Pleasure.
Writer's Voices. Bye, Mary.
Bye-bye.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.